Hi, Simon Smart with you. This week on Life and Faith, we're going to be speaking to Nick Spencer. Nick is the author of a new book called Atheists, The Origin of the Species. The book is a history of atheism that's really relevant for today. Very often we hear these days that atheism developed when humans began to make progress in science and technology. The idea is that as humanity gained knowledge about the world, it shrugged off belief in God because science would now provide the answers to the big human questions. Well, Nick Spencer, in this book, shows that to be a complete myth, a misunderstanding of history. He makes a great case to show that the growth of atheism in its various forms was virtually always a social cause, and its development in Europe had more to do with a reaction to the power of the institution of the church than it did developments in science or philosophy. It's a fascinating argument. Nick Spencer is an author and also research director at Theos, a religion and society think tank in the UK. I caught up with Nick on a recent trip to London. In your book, your argument is that atheism's here to stay, perhaps with a new lease of life, because religion remains a dominant feature of the social, political, and intellectual landscape. In other words, atheism is always a reaction to especially politicised religion. Is that a fair summary?
It's a pretty fair summary, yes. The origins of the book are that in as far as the history of atheism has been told at all, it's been told as a scientific or philosophical idea. So atheism was created because of Darwin, say. And historically that's not the case at all. Scientific advance, development and technology have really only played a peripheral role in the history of atheism, as indeed in a different way has philosophy. My argument is atheism is much better understood as a cultural and in particular a social and political movement, and as a social and political movement that reacted against the different kinds of religion, basically the different kinds of Christianity that it found in Europe.
Now you say that there's a myth surrounding the rise of atheism. Briefly, what is that myth and why has it been so readily adopted as accepted wisdom these days?
The book begins with a creation myth, the story of how a monster terrorised the landscape until it was vanquished by certain brave men with the swords of reason and science and evolution. That is a atheist creation myth, or so I call it, and it originates probably about 140 or so years ago, thereabouts. In the last third of the 19th century, you got a number of highly popular histories of the so-called war of science and religion that put forward this view, which is still very popular today, that somehow science is the vanquisher of God or of religious faith. Now, historically, they are pretty much comprehensively wrong. There are certainly incidents from the history of science and religion, most famously the Galileo incident, which, if understood in a certain way, could feed that myth. But in actual fact, the reason why this myth originated at the end of the 19th century actually had more to do with papal assertion and, if you like, papal aggression at that time than it ever did with the actual historical facts. Science in Europe is a child of Christianity. There's no historical arguing that.
Now, you draw a really interesting parallel with the early Christian church. Christians were called atheists. They were deemed to be atheists because they rejected the power of the gods and were therefore a threat to the earthly powers. It's an interesting historical kind of portrait, isn't it, of then how atheism developed and how it was so, people were so reactive to it and wanting and threatened by it.
It's a very important point to recognise that the word atheist was used in early modern Europe as it had been used sparingly in the classical world, much less to do, at least superficially, with whether you believe in God or not, but what kind of moral and political person you were. Some of the early Christians, like, as it happened, some of the Jews in the classical world, were called atheos, non-believers in God, partly because they didn't like visible idols, and so many classical people didn't understand what they were worshipping, but also because they refused to acknowledge the Caesar as Lord. They were called atheists for that reason. Scroll forward 1500 years, There are probably no atheists, as we understand the term, alive in the 16th and even 17th century. Maybe one or two, but probably not as we understand it. But there were shelves and shelves of books against atheists, partly because they were the reds under the bed of the time, and partly because it was felt that as an atheist, you rejected God, which meant rejecting the king and the emperor and the moral code that society was constructed by, and the hope of eternal life that motivated you, and the fear of eternal judgment that worried you. In other words, you detuned, you undermined all of society. So atheist in the 17th century, much as in the first century, meant almost antisocial. Godless would be a better modern word for it. Godless has overtones of immoral. That's what atheist meant in the 17th century.
You think that atheism is best understood as a series of disagreements about authority rather than just an intellectual exercise that comes, you know, up with different answers to key questions. Is that fair?
That's right, although it's very easy to misunderstand that. I use authority in that sense in two different ways. The first way is the way most of us understand it, political authority. It's a series of disagreements about who has authority over society, who has authority to reign, if you like. But that is tied to a more philosophical question, technically an epistemological question, about the authority of knowledge. How do you know about the world? How do you know what is true about the world? Do you use scripture? Do you use revelation, tradition, reason, personal experience? Which of those things, in which combination, gives you your knowledge of how the way the world works? Well, atheists, so-called, tended to come up with different answers, certainly to that second question, how do you know about the world? And by association, very often, different answers about the second question, how do you run the world? So the disagreements you had between believers and unbelievers was often a series of strange and complex disagreements about this notion of authority.
The big part of your book, it's a great book, by the way, and it makes a really important contribution to this, but it helps people to understand the sort of the way different ideas evolve and what are the things people are reacting to. What we're hoping people will get from this quite substantial study.
I suppose, in the first instance, it's just to understand the issue better. I mentioned my friend who became an atheist. We had many, many years of extremely fruitful and mutually beneficial conversations about it. No doubt such conversations still go on. But I think it's probably fair to say that the tone of the debate between believers and unbelievers has taken a bit of a dip in the last 10 to 15 years or so, which doesn't do anybody a service. I come at the particular debate as a Christian, and therefore, fundamentally, at the end of the day, I believe atheism is wrong. But I tell you, writing the book, my heart was very much with certain atheists at certain times. And quite apart from anything else, believers benefit themselves not at all by misunderstanding or caricaturing unbelief and the reasons for it.
You're listening to Life and Faith. This week we're bringing you an interview with Nick Spencer, the author of a new book, Atheists, The Origin of the Species. Is it important to also draw out the implications of either belief or non-belief?
Very much so. I make the point in the book that the statement, I don't believe in God, or God does not exist, is acceptable in a seminar room. We can discuss that. But if you want to persuade other people, if you wish to articulate that position in a wider public, particularly a public that's been so profoundly shaped by Christianity, it won't do. You have to say, there is no God, and therefore. And what you say at the end of that, and therefore, is critically important. That, in a sense, is one of the reasons why I talk in the book not about atheism, but atheisms, the different ways in which people don't believe in God, or more precisely, don't believe in God, and therefore do advocate a different point of view.
There's no doubting when you read your book that you pick up the fact that a lot of these people were reacting to something that was worth reacting against. There was some terrible corruption and crime of the Christian church, weren't there?
There were, and this is another way you can refer to atheisms rather than atheism. So one of the reasons why the first public atheists, obviously, clearly public atheists in modern European history, were from France in the 18th century. Now, France in the 18th century is no more philosophically or scientifically developed than England or Britain in the 18th century. Britain doesn't develop a tradition of atheism in the 18th century because it has a measure of toleration built into the political system. It's not much tolerance, not as we would understand it today, but there is some wriggle room there. If you're a violent, anti-clerical person in 18th century Britain, you don't have to reject Christianity altogether. You can join the nonconformist church. In France, however, it's much more rigid, much less flexible, and the Catholic Church is richer and far less tolerant than the Anglican Church. There are still people being publicly executed, even tortured for confessional crimes in the 1760s in France. Now, if, as I think a sane, moral person has revulsion against that in France, there's no obvious place for them to go to vent that anger within a Christian context. It's kind of the church or something completely different. That's one of the reasons why France develops this aggressive atheism in the 18th century and Britain doesn't. As an aside, it's one of the reasons why America never really develops a tradition of atheism, because the First Amendment basically means that clerics have never been able to get their hands on power there, so the wells of moral indignation for atheists aren't very deep.
You don't have as much to react against.
Precisely. Russia is another great example. Most of the European countries are liberalising to a greater or lesser degree in the 19th century. Russia does so only in a marginal way. At the beginning of the 20th century, it has a polity that is still similar to that of 100 years ago in many European countries, can be quite brutal, oppressive, and deeply underpinned by the Orthodox Church. That's one of the reasons why you have this eruption of violent atheism in 1917.
Nick, you take great issue with this notion of atheism emerging due to the onset of science as a sort of anti-religious enterprise. In fact, you say that far from breaking free of religion, Christianity was critical in the development of modern science.
The popular belief is that somehow or other it's science that has vanquished religion and brought atheism newborn into the modern world. If you look particularly back in the history of the 17th century, you'll find that the justification and the reason for what became the scientific enterprise was explicitly Christian. In fact, it was pretty explicitly biblical. So someone like Francis Bacon, who is absolutely seminal in the early history of science, put forward the idea that God wrote or revealed himself in two different ways, through his book of words, the Bible, and through his book of works, nature. And it was incumbent on those who worshipped God to understand the Book of Works. That idea was picked up in the formation of the Royal Society 60 or so years later. Its enterprise and activities were founded on the idea that by studying nature, they were somehow understanding the mind of God. And even someone like Charles Darwin, who lost his religious faith, didn't really lose it because of his theory, or only in part because of his theory. It was as much to do with the kind of religious faith he had in the first instance, and the horrible death of his daughter Annie that he witnessed in 1851. So the relationship between science and atheism is much more complicated than the popular picture sometimes has it.
What might you identify as the key contribution to society generally from the Christian faith?
I think it is the concept of the human. We, or at least many of us, take for granted the idea that human beings are of equal, inalienable dignity and worth. Consequently, they enjoy or should enjoy equal rights under an equal rule of law. Often we take that as simply the normal position, the default position that humans adopt. It most certainly is not. In the vast majority of societies, throughout the vast majority of history, humans have not been seen as equal, let alone to have an inalienable worth. I think that is probably Christianity's very greatest gift, and it's not one that we should take for granted.
Well, that was Nick Spencer, author of Atheists, The Origin of the Species. You can hear an extended version of that interview on the Centre for Public Christianity website. Thanks for joining me. I'll see you next time on Life and Faith.